This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow we ask the question, who will fight this war? As the country braces for a possible conflict, we want to hear from the men and women who make up our military, whether they're on the front or behind a computer or maybe behind the wheel of a truck. Call us. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about the coming vote on Iraq by the United Nations Security Council, an unprecedented moment for this council. Sure, there's been wrangling over votes before. Lots of vetoes have been cast. This type of down-to-the-wire suspense is unique, perhaps. Joining us now to talk about the history of the Security Council and where it goes from here is Thomas Wiese. He's director of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies, where he directs the United Nations Intellectual History Project. He's with us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
We do know that this is a critical moment for the Council, obviously. Is it unique? Has this never happened before, where the United States has introduced, backed an important resolution like this without knowing the outcome?
Well, one normally goes to the Security Council knowing the outcome, either positively or negatively. It's quite unusual to not know the outcome of 9 of 15 votes. Normally, one tries to get as many as possible, and in my courses, I try to explain the mathematics of getting 9 votes with all of the permanent members concurring or at least abstaining. And we've never ever had to use this mathematics before. Normally, the votes are much higher. Rarely are they at all contested, and certainly not on important issues.
In the early days of the United Nations, it seemed like the United States would often bring up resolutions knowing that they would be vetoed by the Soviet Union.
That's correct. And over time, for instance, just a few years ago, China vetoed one on the continuation of the force in Guatemala because it had a dispute over Taiwan. But these have always been an opportunity to isolate a single or sometimes two members of the Security Council to try to embarrass them, not to hope that they would stand aside and we would somehow cobble together 9 votes.
And that's turned around on the United States on issues including Israel and in the past, South Africa.
Absolutely. In the past, both with apartheid in South Africa during much of the 70s and 80s, the tactic of the rest of the world was to try to show how isolated the United States and Britain were in relationship to disinvestment in South Africa. And in the Mideast, the United States has frequently been the only country voting against a resolution on Israel. And there the tactics were to try to show how far out of line a single country was, because the result was the same. The resolution was turned down. You may recall in 1999 the resolution that did not go to the Security Council on Kosovo. Everyone assumed that China and Russia would veto that resolution, and therefore, rather than having two countries veto it, which is a substantial negative vote, more substantial than a single one, the NATO decided to go ahead and not bring the resolution to the Security Council because it would have complicated decision-making in many NATO countries to have a negative vote from the Security Council. No vote was better than a negative vote. And so this time, the mathematics as well as the politics are very different.
Just to remind listeners, there are always 15 members of the Security Council. 5 are permanent: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China. If they vote no on anything, that's it. It doesn't pass. There are also 10 elected members of the Council. And Thomas Wiese, there have been proposals from time to time about expanding the number of people on the Council or doing away with the veto of the permanent members.
That's correct. Actually, the only constitutional change, so to speak, in the UN Charter, which is its constitution, that has occurred as concerns the Security Council in 1965. We moved from 11 to 15 members. And in around the UN's anniversary in 1995, that is the 50th anniversary, at the height of the fervor about the Cold War era being something new, a lot of proposals were made to expand the Council. The last time it was expanded in the mid-1960s, 65, to reflect a large number of new countries. This time the notion was to expand it not only because there were still more countries, but also because the balance of power in the year 1995 or the year 2003 is considerably different from the one that we had in 1945 when the five permanent members were nominated. There is that proposition has been discussed since 1995. We have moved nowhere. It's fairly easy to understand that when you have to have the people with vetoes agree to give them up, and they can veto such a proposition, that that notion is not going to go very far.
Well, joining us now to talk about how these decisions actually look like from the inside is Noel Doerr, who was Ireland's representative on the UN Security Council in 1981 and 1982. He joins us from his home in Dublin, Ireland. He's been good enough to speak with us before on this program. Ambassador Doerr, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
When you were on the Security Council, I wonder, did you ever come under the kind of lobbying effort that we hear that the United States and France are engaged in right now?
No, I don't think it was ever quite as strong as that. We did have a difficult time at that stage because the Falklands issue came up in the Security Council. And while the Irish government supported the initial resolution calling on Argentina to withdraw from its seizure of the Falklands in March of 1982, there was a different position taken in May as the war was about to begin. And the Irish government sought to raise the issue at that time in the Council with a view to getting further mediation by the Secretary-General to try to head off the war, which was imminent. That was a difficult time for us in the Council. But no, I don't think that there's been a previous example of the kind of situation we have today.
I'm sure you've read reports about the kind of, let's not put too fine a point on it, arm twisting that's going on. Is that inappropriate?
Well, I think that's the way the world works. Countries act in accordance with their interests. They also perhaps have some higher motives at times, and you cannot expect them to ignore their interests. And obviously, in a situation like this, various means will be used by both sides in the argument to both persuade and induce and cajole countries to vote in a particular way. I think that's the way the world is. Behind it, however, is the basic idea of the United Nations as an international system of legitimacy, which is now accepted by all of the world, a world divided into nearly 200 sovereign states. And the fact that the Charter is universally accepted, even if not universally upheld, perhaps, is an important development in international life. I think it's the first time we've had that kind of international system of legitimacy. Of course, it's imperfect. In many ways, it is, and states will act within it in accordance with their interests. But nevertheless, I think it's important to uphold it.
If you have a question, by the way, about this process, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email TOTN@npr.org. And Mr. Weiss, just wanted to ask you just what Noel Doerr was talking about. I think since the creation of the United Nations, every single member of the Security Council, every single permanent member of the Security Council, has used force without the authorization of the Council.
Absolutely. And this has been what's the real change in the present era is that we sometimes ask for permission to use force, not just use it on our own. And that reflects the change in politics in the post-Cold War era. And it also reflects the fact that you can actually do more of certain kinds of things when you have this blessing than when you do not.
We have an email here from Grant, and it doesn't say where he's from. What is the purpose of a UN resolution if it doesn't mean anything, he writes. In my opinion, if a UN resolution is to be an effective tool in bringing out some desired change, the resolution must be credible, must be backed up by consequences at some point. 10+ years and 16 or 17 resolutions seem to be a timetable that's reaching its upper limit of acceptability. Noel Doerr, you're...
Could I just comment on that? Remember that... It is on the basis of Security Council resolutions enacted since 1990 that sanctions have been imposed on Iraq, quite severe sanctions. It is also on the basis of those resolutions that a very intrusive inspection regime has been imposed on Iraq. Iraq has been forced to accept the kind of intrusive inspection that no other country has ever had to accept in regard to disarmament and so on. That is an enforcement by the Council of its decisions. So there has been enforcement of Security Council resolutions. In fact, I think the present dispute is whether to give more time to those inspections or not. But I do not think it's quite right to say that Security Council resolutions are toothless. They have been and can be effective, and they have, in fact, provided the basis for a very, very severe sanctions regime on Iraq and for this very intrusive inspection, which is going on as we speak.
We're talking with Noel Doerr, who was Ireland's ambassador to the United Nations and served as its representative on the UN Security Council back in the early 1980s, and with Thomas Weiss, who's co-director of the UN Intellectual History Project, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Thomas Weiss, I think this one goes to you. It's an email question from Mark in Palo Alto. How did France and China get their permanent seats? Neither, he writes, were world powers when they were given their seats, like the U.S., the U.K., and the USSR.
That was the politics at the end of the Second World War. In fact, the seat at that time was occupied by the nationalists who held power, and they maintained that seat until 1971, largely at Western insistence. So this is not
that was the
first time.
Republic of China, what we now generally refer to as Taiwan.
Taiwan, that's right.
If I may intervene here, that the United Nations was planned during the war by the major allies, and in fact the blueprint for it was drawn up at a conference in Dumbarton Oaks in Washington in late 1944, and it was largely the United States, the United Kingdom, and at that time Soviet Russia, but they brought in China and later France, because these were the major allied powers at the end of the Second World War. It is interesting perhaps to note that these countries were at war at the time, in a kind of total war. So we must assume that they were serious when they planned the UN. In other words, it wasn't just a high-minded ideal. It was something that leaders like Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin at least hoped would work in the peace and would regulate the world after the war was over. But they planned for it as early as 1942-43, and the major plan was drawn up in 1944 in Washington.
Given France's historical role and the fact that they had a large colonial empire, it seemed that at the time that they would continue to play a major role on the world scene. So it was logical, even though the questioner is perfectly correct, that France hadn't played a very large role in the victory of the Second World War, and the Chinese seat was occupied by a puppet of sorts.
You could say that the United Nations was really a continuation of the wartime alliance into the peace, because the basis for the initial membership of 50 or 51 states in the UN was that all of them were at least nominally at war with Germany or Japan in March 1945, and they were the founder members of the UN. So the underlying idea was that the alliance in the war would continue into the peace. What has happened since then is that the United Nations has grown into a universal organization of states. As the state system has expanded, we now have 191 members in the UN instead of the initial 51, and it has become the first universally accepted system of legitimacy for states in history, just at the time when the world has organized itself as a world of sovereign states with the end of colonialism and empires in the past. So that, I think, is important.
Patty Deke in Portland, Oregon writes a question. I've heard these used interchangeably. She asks, are there four possible ways to vote in the Security Council? Yes, no, veto, and abstain? In other words, Tom Weiss, is it possible for a permanent member to vote no without casting a veto?
Well, actually, this is an interesting historical development. The charter is written that one wasn't supposed to be able to abstain. One was supposed to have to concur amongst the permanent five members. The language of the charter says that you must have a certain number of votes, in this case nine now, with concurring votes from the permanent members. Practice dictated that over the years an abstention was seen as a different kind of yes, or somewhere at least not a no. So, in fact, the questioner is correct that you can vote yes. There are two different kinds of yeses and two nos, depending on whether you're
really
a permanent member or not.
Really, four options. I mean, what the term veto is simply a casual term used to describe a no vote by a permanent member.
So, no mm-hmm. by a permanent member is
a veto.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The term is usually probably not used. If it is the no vote by a permanent member that blocks the decision, then it is customary to use the word veto.
So yeah, if
it failed for want of nine votes and a permanent member voted against among those who voted against, then probably by just custom they wouldn't use the word veto. But the reality is that there are three possible votes. There's a yes vote, a no vote, or an abstention. And if one of the five permanent members casts a no vote, that is, in ordinary language, a veto. So there's not a fourth position.
We will be exploring all these shadings of interpretation and language when the vote happens, perhaps as soon as tomorrow. Gentlemen, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Noel Doerr, former ambassador to the UN for the Republic of Ireland, speaking with us from Dublin. And that was Thomas Weiss of the Ralph Bunche Institute for International Studies at the City University of New York. He was with us from the studios of member station WRNI in Rhode Island. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.